I picked a passage in the middle of Galatians 4 because it's one of my favorite parts of the book of Galatians. It's a little bit more obscure than some of the verses you've memorized and are familiar with, and it's just full of passion. Here is Paul with as much passion as he ever writes with. So I want to drop you in the middle of Galatians, Galatians 4, and we're going to cover verses 8 through 20. Galatians 4, starting at verse 8. This is, by the way, the transitional moment in Paul's letter to the Galatians. He is about to shift gears from doctrine to practical application. He always did this. He follows a similar pattern in practically every one of his epistles. He would first expound doctrine, and then he would apply it. And I've showed you this before, so I won't belabor it now. But that's how Galatians is laid out. Chapters 5 and 6 are practical material based on the doctrinal foundation of the first four chapters. And the practical section starts at the beginning of chapter 5. But here in the passage we're looking at today, we have an extended section that's kind of uncharacteristic of Paul because it is so passionate. And it's neither doctrinal instruction nor practical application. It's just Paul pouring out his heart to the Galatians. It's an extended appeal from the Apostle Paul to the believers in the Galatian churches. And as I said, it's full of passion. He's simply unburdening his heart to these churches. He's writing, by the way, to multiple churches in a region rather than one church in a big city. And he does this in a way that's remarkable. And it gives us an excellent insight into the heart and the personal character of the Apostle Paul. And it shows us how, as a pastor, he loved his people. He moves briefly out of the didactic apostolic mode, and he assumes kind of here a pastoral and personal tone in order to make this direct appeal to people whom he loves. And it's obvious that he loves them. His emotions are all over this passage, and it's an amazing range of emotion that he displays. This whole passage is filled with several different kinds of personal feelings. He's unburdening his heart to them, as I said, and he's expressing how he feels about them as people. He's at the point in the epistle where he's finished with the doctrinal section. You might expect him at this point to sum up everything he has said so far. That's what he would normally do. But this is not a dispassionate analysis of the doctrinal issues that he's been talking about for four chapters. He's just pouring out his soul. And he is clearly upset. He's heartbroken about how quickly the Galatians had moved away from the simplicity of the gospel, and they had got bogged down in a bunch of confusion about the Old Testament ceremonial laws. And he's deeply burdened about them and their spiritual status. At this point, he's not even sure of their salvation. And he wants to convey that concern to them. So he just tells them plainly what he's feeling. He employs almost every imaginable tone and temperament in the appeal he makes to them. And in the space of just a few sentences, he moves in and out freely between expressions of concern and candor and exasperation and the pain of his own personal hurt, heartbreak over their confusion, fatherly kindness, fatherly sternness, and just about every feeling in between. And in just a few sentences here, he covers the gamut of reproof, rebuke, exhortation, and instruction in righteousness. So let me read this passage and listen for the different ways he expresses his feelings. This section is a little bit long, so stay with me. I'm reading verses 8 through 20. I'm reading from the ESV. He says, "Formerly, when you did not know God, you were enslaved to those that by nature are not gods. But now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by God, how can you turn back again to the weak and worthless elementary principles of the world, whose slaves you want to be once more? You observe days and months and seasons and years. I'm afraid I may have labored over you in vain. Brothers, I entreat you, become as I am, for I also have become as you are. You did me no wrong. You know it was because of a bodily ailment that I preached the gospel to you at first, and though my condition was a trial to you, you did not scorn or despise me, but received me as an angel of God, as Jesus Christ. What then has become of the blessing you felt? For I testify to you that, if possible, you would have gouged out your eyes and given them to me. Have I then become your enemy by telling you the truth? They make much of you, but for no good purpose. They want to shut you out, that you may make much of them. It is always good to be made much of for a good purpose, and not only when I am present with you, my little children, for whom I am again in the anguish of childbirth, until Christ is formed in you. I wish I could be present with you now and change my tone, for I am perplexed about you. Now, notice there's a tone of heartbroken sadness there, and I hope it comes through. But I want to point out something important about this section regarding the way Paul dealt with people under his pastoral care. This whole section is remarkable for its complete lack of any hint of heavy-handedness or authoritarianism. Even though Paul is clearly upset and distressed in his mind, and prepared to use every resource at his disposal to persuade the Galatians that they need to see the light, the one thing Paul does not do is wield his authority as a threat. And that's really remarkable, because Paul spent a considerable amount of time and effort in the early part of this epistle establishing and defending his apostleship. He even talked about how at one point he withstood the apostle Peter to his face and rebuked him publicly. And we know the Apostle Paul could be stern when he had to. In 2 Corinthians, for example, there are a few places where he threatened to come and deal with the problems in the Corinthian church by the straightforward use of his authority. Basically says to them, you know, don't push me, or I'll come and deal with you. He's like threatening them with his authority. That was never Paul's first response. He didn't begin a confrontation like this with an apostolic smackdown. But here in this context, he doesn't even bring up anything like that as a possibility. And it's not that this section is devoid of any expression of Paul's apostolic authority. He deals with them as a father talking to his children. He scolds them. He rebukes them. And in verse 19, he refers to them as my little children. So all through this section, you get a sense of his authority over them. There's no question that he has apostolic and almost fatherly authority over them, but he doesn't use raw authority as a threat against them. Instead, he pleads with them, and he earnestly entreats them to get back on track spiritually and to embrace the truth just because it is the truth. And so this whole section becomes an appeal, not a threat. And I think that's significant. Not only that, but notice he uses a variety of tones with them. It's clear on the one hand that he's exasperated, right? That comes through. He's deeply and personally grieved by their flirtation with a different gospel and a different message than what he had originally given them. They had heard the gospel from him, and now these false teachers come through, and they're confused by that. It's a sign of rank disloyalty to the apostle who had founded those churches, and he's frustrated. He's bitterly disappointed, and I don't think it would be going too far to say that there is a true sense in which he must have been angry, and he's angry in one sense with the Galatians themselves. In fact, when he starts out this section, you almost get the sense for a moment that he is about to unleash his wrath in all its fury against them. But then, in the next breath, he just sounds discouraged and disappointed. And he says he's afraid that the labor he invested in them might prove to be all in vain. And it's clear that he's feeling a deeply personal kind of pain because of their disloyalty to him. And he expresses that pain in such a poignant way that you might begin to wonder whether his own feelings are so personally hurt that he's going to have trouble ever getting over it. If he stopped at verse 11, you might wonder if he would ever think fondly of the Galatians again. But then he speaks tenderly about how warmly they received him when he first came. He remembers their kindness to him. He had come into that region the first person ever bringing the gospel message. He founded these churches, and he recounts the remarkable kindness they showed him, and it's such a tender reflection that all you can hear is his profound sadness. It's clear that more than the idea that he's angry, what comes across is that the Apostle Paul is sad. And he suddenly sounds more melancholy than angry. Verse 16, have I then become your enemy by telling you the truth? But then he thinks about the false teachers and how they're trying to woo the Galatians away from their loyalty to Paul and get them to embrace the heretical point of view and become proselytes and followers of this legalistic, pharisaical system that they represented. And all of a sudden, the tone of indignation surfaces again. Verse 17, they make much of you, but for no good purpose. And finally, this great apostle, spiritual father to all the congregations in Galatia, compares himself to a mother giving birth. More than 36 hours of labor, by the way. Verse 19. And this is vivid imagery. It's perfect for the situation because the comparison to birth pangs sums up everything Paul was feeling about the Galatians. Intense, unimaginable pain, a profound love for them, a passionate desire for what was best for them, a willingness to suffer and to sacrifice for them, and a sense of parenthood and personal responsibility to look out for their welfare. All while they were oblivious to the pain and labor he had endured for their benefits. Every mother can relate to this, right? It's a perfect message for Mother's Day. He's telling the Galatians, you're just like a bunch of little kids. And now the Galatians are toying with the idea of abandoning Paul completely and following after a bunch of false teachers who had nothing personal invested in them. The Judaizers, who in essence wanted to impose all the demands of Old Testament ceremonial law on the church because they could not abide the notion that uncircumcised Gentiles could be freely forgiven without first converting to Judaism and placing themselves under the law. And these false teachers, the Judaizers, had loaded the law on top of the gospel to the point where they nullified the freedom of grace. They'd never done anything for the Galatians except confuse them. They had challenged the Apostle Paul's doctrine. They had questioned his apostolic credentials. And they had undermined his authority and belittled him in every way they could. And in fact, as far as the people in the Galatian churches were concerned, all the Judaizers had done for them was try to bind a heavy burden of legalistic obligations on their backs. And yet, the Galatians were being seduced by this. Their ingratitude, their callous lack of loyalty to the Apostle Paul is stunning, really. And it's no wonder that he sounds discouraged and sick at heart as he writes this passage. But you have to admire Paul's great skill as a writer, not to mention his competence as a pastor and his courage as a great contender for the faith. Also, his compassion as a spiritual parent to these people. This section is just 13 verses long, and yet, as I said at the beginning, it runs the gamut of emotion and style and tone. And in that short space, Paul is able to express all of his feelings with total candor, with incredible power, in an amazing economy of words, without ever once sounding cruel or harsh. I wish I could do that. I tend to sound harsh. I know it. I see at least five distinct stages in this appeal to the Galatians. Each stage is just one or two verses long. Well, all of them, I think, are two verses long. But all five stages show us the range of emotion the Apostle Paul felt. They powerfully appeal to every vestige of conscience and conviction the Galatians might have felt, and they expose the inhumanity and the evil that lay behind the Judaizer strategy as these false teachers, the Judaizers, shrewdly and dishonestly tried to drive a wedge between the Apostle Paul and several churches full of people who had come to Christ through his ministry. And so let's look at this. Let's look in order at five stages of Paul's appeal to the Galatians, and we'll try to learn something of how he dealt with people and why he was so exercised about this particular threat to the gospel. So I'll give these to you as we go through them if you want to take them down. Stage number one, verses 8 and 9, he questions them. That's how he starts. He questions them. He begins this lengthy personal appeal with a single question that is designed to provoke them to face the destructive spiritual implications if they decide to follow these Judaizers and abandon Paul's apostolic leadership. Now, here's just a little bit of context for you. Remember, or you may not remember because it's been years since we studied this, but in those first seven verses of Galatians 4, Paul is pointing out that Christianity offers university-level spiritual instruction compared to what the Judaizers were teaching was like a daycare center spiritual lessons. The Old Testament ceremonial law, that was the elementary principles of the law. And this is the point he opens this chapter with. The Judaizers, you know, had suggested to the Galatians that the Apostle Paul had only taught them the elementary things, the bare bones basics of spiritual truth, that Paul had given them a kind of stripped down gospel message because he didn't even tell them about the necessity of circumcision and the dietary laws and the elaborate system of feast days and ceremonies that were prescribed in the Old Testament. These were Gentile converts, and Paul hadn't brought them under the law. And so the Judaizers said, what he's teaching you is elementary. That's just entry-level stuff. We'll give you the advanced version. That's what they said. But Paul says the truth, the real truth, is just the opposite. And the flow of redemptive history proves it. God gave the Mosaic law as a kind of guardianship to the nation of Israel in her state of spiritual infancy. The law was a chaperone, he says, designed to conduct the Israelites safely through a world of evil and deliver them into the arms of their Messiah and deliverer. It was the law that was elementary. And the law itself was not a deliverer. It was designed to condemn sin and to deter people from sinning and to show the exceeding sinfulness of sin. The law was also designed to eliminate every hope from every sinner that we could ever attain righteousness on our own, because the law condemns us for our sin without offering any kind of eternal remedy. And the Pharisees' mistake, these Judaizers' mistake, was that they believed they could attain a true and sufficient righteousness of their own through the law. Paul says this in Romans 10, verse 3, says this about them. Being ignorant of the righteousness of God and seeking to establish their own righteousness, they did not submit themselves to God's righteousness. They saw the law not as something to instruct them and condemn their sin, but they saw the law itself as the means of salvation. And even though they couldn't keep the law, they never gave up trying, and they would paper over their sins with hypocrisy, which only compounded their guilt. And that's all the law can ever do. And the Judaizers were trying to import the very same error that Jesus had condemned the Pharisees for into the church under the guise of claiming to teach an advanced version of Christianity. They were teaching the Galatians that they could actually achieve a kind of righteousness on their own. Not only that, they needed to do that, the Judaizers said. By insisting you had to be circumcised in order to be saved, they were essentially claiming that you must have some righteousness of your own to bring to the table, or else you could never be saved at all. And if the Galatians accepted the Judaizers' doctrine, it would not put them on a higher plane of advanced Christianity. It would be like demoting themselves to nursery school. And that, again, is the point Paul makes in those first seven verses of chapter 4. But now he says, the full truth is even more grim than that. If the Galatians bought the Judaizers' doctrine, that would show that they were indeed trusting something other than Christ for their salvation. You see, what the Judaizers were peddling was a totally different gospel with a whole different way of salvation. And so the religion represented by these Judaizers wasn't even authentic Christianity. It wasn't a different denomination. It wasn't just a different way of looking at things. It was a whole different religion. It wasn't Christianity. And Paul has made that point several times in several ways throughout this epistle, starting with verses 8 and 9 in chapter 1, where he pronounces a curse on any different gospel. He's carefully drawn as clear a line as possible between the true gospel and the religion of the Judaizers. And now he makes that point once more by telling the Galatians he's concerned about whether they've really abandoned their paganism or not. Look at verse 8. formerly, when you did not know God, you were enslaved to those that by nature are not gods. Now remember, these were Gentile people who had come out of totally pagan backgrounds. Most of them were from a highly Romanized culture, and so their religion was essentially superstition based on mythology. The Romans had adapted ancient Greek myths, and they'd given the Greek gods Roman names, and that was the dominant religion throughout the Roman Empire. The chief god of the Greeks was Zeus, of course, but the Romans called him Jupiter. Dionysius, the god of wine in the Greek pantheon, was called Bacchus in the Roman system. Apollo had the same name in both languages. You had goddesses like Diana, the goddess of the hunt, who was worshipped in the city of Ephesus. Her Greek name was Artemis. And there was this entire system, which you probably studied in high school, that had been carried over from ancient Greece, and by the first century was so deeply ingrained in the culture that they really made up part of the Roman worldview, and yet it wasn't taken very seriously by anyone. In other words, there probably were not many people who really believed the fables that were told about the gods, but all the superstitions were carefully followed anyway, in much the same way that superstitious people today still think, you know, that Friday the 13th is bad luck, and some people refuse to walk under ladders and all of that. It was generally acknowledged that the gods weren't real, but the superstitions framed their culture anyway. By the way, Augustus Caesar, the emperor in power at the time of Jesus' birth, had declared himself a priest and tried to reform the Roman religion. He originally wanted to do away with the superstitious approach and stress spiritual disciplines like prayer and ethical values and contemplative piety. He wanted the Roman religion to be taken seriously. But of course, the religion was false to begin with, and it was corrupt to the core. And by the end of the first century, the Caesars themselves were deifying themselves, declaring themselves to be gods, and people were supposed to treat the Caesars as if they were gods, even though everyone knew they were just men, and some of them were pretty low-life men too. And so when Paul says in verse 8, you were enslaved to those that by nature are not gods, not only was that literally true, but the Galatians themselves very likely knew that the beings they worshipped weren't really gods, even while they were still in bondage to paganism, before they ever even heard of the gospel. Now, notice what Paul says, verse 9. But now that you have come to know God, or rather to be known by Him, how can you turn back again to the weak and worthless elementary principles of the world, whose slaves you want to be once more? He's suggesting that if they buy into the Judaizer system, that would be no better than going back to paganism. Both the Judaizers and the pagans taught systems of works righteousness. Both of them made salvation dependent on something the sinner must do for himself. And therefore, both paganism and the religion of the Judaizers were simply different ways of rejecting Christ, because they both taught that the work Christ has done on behalf of sinners isn't quite enough. By the way, I'd love to take time to expound on the way he changes the words when he says, you have come to know God, or rather, to be known by God. That stresses the fact that their salvation was God's work. It's not something they did on their own by a free will choice they made. This is yet another emphatic expression of Paul's conviction that God is sovereign in salvation. But time doesn't permit us to follow that line of thought this morning. We have too many verses to cover. So notice the expression Paul uses to describe works religion in verse 9. The weak and worthless elementary principles of the world. The New King James Version says, the weak and beggarly elements. It's the very same Greek term he uses back in verse 3, where he says, when we were children, we were enslaved to the elementary principles of the world. Elementary principles. He's talking about the ABCs, the kindergarten curriculum, kids' stuff. That's the idea. Now, I don't think Paul is suggesting that there's any kind of moral equivalence between paganism and authentic Old Testament Judaism. That's not his point. Authentic Old Testament Judaism correctly understood, did not teach salvation by works. And he made that point in chapter 3 by showing that Abraham was justified by faith. And that's the only way anybody could ever be justified by faith. We could ever be saved. Abraham's faith, not the works prescribed by the Mosaic Law, but the faith of Abraham is what defined the soteriology of the Old Testament. The Pharisees had that totally confused. The Judaizers picked up on that same confusion and were trying to peddle it in the church. But Paul says, no, it wasn't the works of the law. It was the faith modeled by Abraham that was the instrument of justification even in the Old Testament. But he does say that both Old Testament law and the paganism of Rome, all of that was elementary, kindergarten-level spirituality. And if you want a system of works, Paul says, ultimately, legalism based on Moses' law isn't any better than rank paganism. If you turn away from the gospel to works, you're just as lost under one system as you are under the other. If you're going to drop out of university and go back to nursery school, take your pick, paganism or legalistic Judaism, it really doesn't ultimately make a lot of difference. That's the point he's making. And so he raises that point again in the form of a question, verse 9. How can you turn back again to a work system that is tantamount to the same kind of religion you followed as pagans? You want to go back to spiritual infancy? He says, and there's a tone of disgust and maybe a bit of scorn in the question, I think. How could you do this? What were you thinking? Do you really want to act like a bunch of sniveling toddlers who can't get past the ABCs? He's clearly disturbed with them. And so he questions them the same way my dad used to question me when I did something really stupid as a little kid, you know? It makes you feel foolish and childish. And that's exactly Paul's point. So he starts with the question. That's number one. And then number two, in verses 10 and 11, this is stage two of his plea. He rebukes them. Stage two, he rebukes them. His tone here seems to become more stern. Suddenly in verse 10, notice that the question of verse 9 is rhetorical. How can you turn again back to the ABCs? And not only that, but he uses some pretty strong adjectives, weak and beggarly elements, weak and worthless elementary principles. He's not waiting for an answer from them because there is no rational answer. Paul knows he had made the gospel message perfectly clear for them. They had no valid excuse to turn away from the simplicity of the gospel to a complex system of works that was made by taking the ABCs of the Old Testament and all the ritual and all that stuff and overlaying it on Christianity. There was no excuse for this. But let's not be too hard on the Galatians. We all have a tendency to do the same thing. We look for some secret way to attain sanctification or blessedness other than simple faith in Christ. The human heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. And grace forces us to acknowledge how hell-bent and deceitful our own hearts really are. And the human heart simply doesn't like that. So our own hearts will find ways to convince us, you know, that, well, you're not really so bad after all. I mean, look at all the other people who are worse. And so our heart will seek ways to gain approval for itself. And before you know it, we are all susceptible to the same kind of works-oriented religious attitudes that had sucked the Galatians back into the vortex of the Judaizers' false doctrine. That, after all, is what the entire Roman Catholic system is all about. Works and ceremonies and an external show of righteousness, all that stem from the human heart's refusal to acknowledge its own poverty. And we all have that same tendency. It's something we constantly have to fight, no matter how much we think we understand the gospel. The Galatians were drawn to the Judaizers' doctrine because it looked so much more complicated and therefore so much more advanced and sophisticated than the simple message they had heard from Paul. Plus, the Judaizers could point to Old Testament scripture that seemed to justify the practice of circumcision and the dietary restrictions and all the feasts and ceremonies and the holy days. After all, it was God who instituted these things for Israel. And that's exactly what had the Galatians so confused. Verse 10, you observe days and months and seasons and years. These were all rituals and feast days the Old Testament prescribed. And they had significance to Old Testament Israel. But remember, these were all either backward-looking symbols like the Passover, which pointed back to the deliverance from Egypt, commemorating the Exodus, or they were types and pictures that pointed forward to Christ. That was true of the Passover feast itself, because the deliverance of Passover actually symbolized a greater deliverance that the Messiah would bring. And the priestly system and all of that, all of those symbols pointed to Christ. But they were all completely unnecessary now because the substance is better than a shadow. The reality is superior to the symbol. And clear doctrine is better than types and pictures. In the words of Hebrews chapter 10, verse 1, the law has but a shadow of the good things to come instead of the true form of those realities. And in Colossians 2, verses 16 and 17, Paul writes, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. These things are a shadow of things to come, but the substance belongs to Christ. Notice in that Galatians text how he covers the ceremonial law, the dietary laws, and the Sabbath observance. He says all of these things pointed to Christ. He's the substance that cast those shadows. And to turn away from Christ and retreat to a shadowy symbol that merely pointed to him is an expression of unbelief. It would be like, to illustrate, if I took a dark, blurry, silhouette-style black-and-white picture of the back of Darlene's head and made a shrine out of that picture and talked to the picture and leave gifts at the picture shrine, but all while I'm doing that, refusing to acknowledge Darlene's presence or look at her actual face when she's right there in the room with me. I've never tried that, but I know she'd slap me silly. I mean, do you think she would feel honored by the respect I showed to a blurry picture of her? I don't think so. The picture's a symbol and not even a particularly good one. If I turned away from my wife to devote my time to a bad picture of the outline of her shadow, that would be the same thing as rejecting her. And that's what the Galatians were doing by turning back to these outmoded ceremonies of Old Testament Jewish law. And they should have understood that. They should have known better. It's inconceivable that the Apostle Paul omitted to teach them these things. But they were seduced by the lies anyway, and therefore Paul's rebuke is firm and abrupt. He gives them this scorching rebuke, verse 11, I am afraid I may have labored over you in vain. I'm afraid I've been wasting my time ministering to you, he says. If you're going to turn away from the gospel and go back to a system that's no better than rank paganism, nothing I've ever taught you will do you any good whatsoever. That's the message he's giving them. And the clear implication is actually very frightening. He is fearful for them that they are going to end up in hell having turned away from the gospel. The issue is that serious, and Paul doesn't shy away from saying so. And he makes it as plain as possible. You have to give him credit for the clarity of his rebuke. But this would be a frightening letter to receive from an apostle, especially an apostle whom you loved and whose ministry was so far-reaching. This must have brought them up short. It's practically a verbal slap in the face. But there's nothing mean-spirited about it. He's simply relating to them the very real fear that had him concerned. He's being honest for their sake, not to hurt them, but to waken them up to the very real danger. He's shouting the alarm as loudly and distinctly as possible because the danger is very real and very imminent. And this is where his appeal takes an interesting turn. This is where I usually mess up in counseling or admonishing people, because it's tempting at a point like this just to turn up the volume and camp on the point and find several more ways of being straightforward and scary and stern. Because you know the point's being made, and finally you're being heard, yell louder. That's what my flesh tends to think. And so when you read verse 11, you're more or less braced for Paul to really unload on them in the next few verses, but he doesn't do that. He does the exact opposite. He turns the volume down, and he suddenly takes a very tender tone with them, and this moves into the third phase of his appeal. If you're following the outline, he starts by questioning them, verses 8 and 9. Then he rebukes them, verses 10 and 11. Now, verses 12 through 16, four verses here, he pleads with them. Notice, this is the longest section of the whole appeal. No other phase is, well, in fact, all the others are exactly two verses long. And so it's interesting to see how strongly he makes a point in relatively few words and then moves on. It shows how masterful he was with language and rhetoric. This is a well-crafted appeal, and he never belabors a point. But when he gets to the point of making a tender plea, he takes more than twice as long as he spends on any other aspect of this appeal. And you can't miss how abruptly the tone changes between verses 11 and 12. Just when you think he's going to drop the hammer on them, he dials it back, and he speaks to them in a very personal way. Brothers, I entreat you. Now, remember, he's just implied that perhaps they're not brothers at all, but apostates in the making. But then, just as soon as he says that, he quickly makes it clear that he wants to give them the benefit of the doubt. Brothers, I entreat you, become as I am, for I also have become as you are. That's a reference, by the way, to the principle of 1 Corinthians 9:22, where he says, I become all things to all people, that by all means I might save some. And especially 1 Corinthians 9:21, to those outside the law, I became as one outside the law, that I might win those outside the law. That's the Galatians. That's a perfect description of how Paul evangelized them. And back in 1 Corinthians 9, verse 23, he adds, I do it all for the sake of the gospel. He had dispensed with the trappings of the law and Jewish culture for their sakes. Now, you remember Paul's background. He says he was a Hebrew of the Hebrews. He was trained after several generations as a Pharisee. His father was a Pharisee. Apparently, his grandfather was a Pharisee. His commitment to the Jewish culture was so deeply inbred in Paul, it must have been a shock to his whole worldview and system when God called him to be the minister, the apostle to the Gentiles. And he goes into the region of the Galatians, and he dispenses with all the trappings of the law and his culture, and he does it for their sakes, to make sure that the gospel was clear and unencumbered by any confusion about ceremonial laws and stuff like that. And now he pleads with them to become like him, free from the trappings of any kind of religious ceremony. Look at the end of Galatians 4:12. You did me no wrong, he says, or as the New King James Version has it, you have not injured me at all. What he means by that is slightly ambiguous. He might mean that he wasn't harmed spiritually by setting aside the ceremonial observances of the law for their sake. He didn't forfeit anything essential by becoming like a Gentile for the Gentiles. And that's certainly true. Or it could be that that sentence at the end of verse 12 actually introduces the string of memories he's going to recite for them in verses 13 through 15. You did me no wrong, he says. On the contrary, you've always been especially kind to me. And he recites how they had received him when he first came to their region. Now, unfortunately, we don't have time in one session this morning to explore all of the interesting questions that come up in verses 13 through 15. Notice verse 13. He says when he came to them, he was suffering from some physical infirmity. What was it? Bottom line, he doesn't say. Some think it was malaria because he would have traveled through a malaria-infested region to get there. I'm more inclined to think, based on clues right here in this context and elsewhere, that Paul had some kind of serious problem with his eyes. And it may have affected his vision. And it may have even affected how he looked. Because verse 14 seems to hint that it involved something that might have caused people to turn away from him or be repulsed by him. And he says in verse 15, I testify to you that if possible, you would have gouged out your own eyes and given them to me. And you remember that incident in Acts 23 where the high priest slaps Paul and Paul insults him? Because he didn't know he was a high priest? Well, the high priest would have been dressed as a high priest. One possible reason Paul didn't realize he was the high priest would be if his eyesight was bad. And here in Galatians, at the very end of the epistle, Galatians 6:11, when he signs his name to the parchment, he says, "See with what large letters I am writing to you with my own hand." So I think he had a problem with his eyes. My dad has macular degeneration. He can see shapes and figures, but not recognize faces, not see letters as he writes them. So he writes with a very large hand. That's exactly what Paul is describing here. And it could be that this blindness first began to affect him severely about the time he went to the region of Galatia. But the bottom line is, he doesn't say specifically what he's talking about. The Galatians knew what it was, and that's what's important. They had burned into their memory the events surrounding Paul's first arrival there. And so when he gave him the gospel, they had shown him the utmost kindness, and he reminds them of that. He knows their love for him, and he pleads with them on that basis. And then he poignantly asks them, verse 16, "Have I then become your enemy by telling you the truth?" Telling them the truth was the only thing he'd ever done. That's what they originally liked about him. Was that now going to be a reason for them to turn against him? That's a powerful and effective argument, coming on the heels of a rebuke, because this underscores the truth that the only possible motives Paul had for writing in the first place, such a rebuke for them, was his love for them and his love for the truth. So the tenderness of this section doesn't diminish at all from the force of the earlier rebuke. In fact, it adds to the power of the rebuke much more than it would have if he had simply turned up the volume and become more and more severe. That might have alienated them. Here he appeals to their affection for him. So follow the pattern here. If you're taking notes, you have 3 points so far. He questions them, then he rebukes them, then he pleads with them, and now fourth, verses 17 and 18, he warns them. He warns them. Now, this warning is about the shady motives of the Judaizers. They were just like the Pharisees. Remember, I said this earlier, the Pharisees whom Jesus rebuked in Matthew 23:15. He says, "You travel across land and sea to make a single proselyte, and when he becomes a proselyte, you make him twice as much a child of hell as yourself." That's what Jesus said to the Pharisees. And that's what the Judaizers were trying to do with the Galatians. They had ulterior motives. Verse 17, "They make much of you, but for no good purpose." That's a little hard to understand in the ESV. Here's a place where the NIV, which I'm not normally fond of, but I think the NIV gets the sense of it a little bit better. The NIV says this: "These people are zealous to win you over, but for no good. What they want to do is alienate you from us so that you may have a zeal for them." In other words, don't be flattered by the fact that these guys have taken such an interest in you, Paul says. They have no good motives. In fact, their doctrine would estrange you from us and shut you out of the kingdom. And their motive in teaching these things is simply to make you into followers of them. It's for self-aggrandizing motives. It's not for your good. It's for their egos. Verse 18, this is still the NIV. "It's fine to be zealous, provided the purpose is good, and it's fine to be zealous always, not just when I am with you," Paul says. So be zealous for the truth of the gospel. And Paul says, you shouldn't need me to be there present with you to tell you that. If you really believe the gospel, zeal for the truth of the gospel ought to issue forth from your own hearts without me telling you this. And the fact that the Galatians did not seem to be particularly zealous for the truth of the gospel, unless Paul was there in person to goad them on, it seems to bring his focus back to his primary concern. And it's this, that given the ease with which the Judaizers were able to seduce the Galatians away from the fundamental truths of the gospel, was it possible that the Galatians weren't even really true believers after all? And so Paul's come full circle now. And it brings him to the final phase of this long appeal. You have a question, then a rebuke, then a plea, then a warning. And now finally, number five, he scolds them. He scolds them. And this is a very tender scolding. And in fact, he switches from paternal mode to maternal mode. He speaks to them the way a mother would. I always preferred to get rebuked by my mom rather than my dad, you know, because she used a warm and familiar way of scolding me. It got through, but by appealing to my heart. And that's what he does here. He uses this familiar expression to address them, my little children. He uses the imagery of childbirth to explain why he's so deeply troubled. My little children, for whom I am again in the anguish of childbirth until Christ is formed in you. I wish I could be present with you now and change my tone, for I am perplexed about you. And that last phrase, I think, is better translated the way you have it in the NASB and several other translations. I am in doubt about you. I have grave doubts about you, he says. Now notice, he pictures their sanctification like childbirth. And he uses the imagery in a way that underscores how much he personally had invested in them. The pain of their delivery into Christ's likeness is Paul's pain. The yearning to see them become what they ought to be is his personal passion. This is all deliberately very personal and very warm towards them. This is not a harsh scolding. This is the plea of someone who loves them the way a mother loves her children. And notice he says, verse 20, I wish I could be present with you now and change my tone. He's very eager to convey a specific tone. That makes it especially significant that he's already gone through every tone from harsh severity to tender compassion in just a few verses. And you have to ask, what tone did he want to convey? That's a hard thing to really control when you're writing, as I've learned. Sometimes when I used to be writing my blog, it seemed like the things I wrote that I thought were the most tender and warm-hearted typically made people angry. Because they read everything I write with a harsh tone. Like I said, I come across that way, and I know it, and I'm sorry. But what tone is Paul trying to convey here? Well, we know from 2 Corinthians 10, verse 10, that Paul's reputation was that his letters sounded more harsh than he ever was in person. 2 Corinthians 10:10. For they say, his letters are weighty and strong, but his bodily presence is weak, and his speech of no account. In other words, he was more of a softy in person and not so fluent with his speech as he was with his writing. Or at least that was his reputation. Harsh in his letters, kind of a softy in person. And here he seems to be longing to be with the Galatians just so that they could hear the compassion and concern in his voice, so that they wouldn't think he was merely trying to be insulting or unduly harsh, because he's raising a very difficult question about whether they really have embraced the gospel or not. Are you really saved? He's not saying that to insult them. He's saying that because he really does have his doubts. And so you have to read that closing phrase of our text in that light. This is a broken-hearted, compassionate expression of deep and genuine personal concern. The end of verse 20, I have doubts about you. Now, our time is gone. We can't go any further with this now. But let me just say by way of practical application that this is a reminder to all of us that we need to examine ourselves to see whether we're really in the faith. That's what he's urging them to do. And it applies to us as well, because it's true that our hearts are deceptive and we easily are moved from the principle of grace to a religion of self-righteousness, works. This is serious business, and the gospel is clear. It's not something to be taken lightly, and the nuances of truth are not to be dismissed with a wave of the hand, which is what people today would do. The average well-known Christian leader today, instead of taking the approach Paul takes here, would look at the Judaizers and say, well, they've got most things right. Let's not be too critical with them. But Paul says this is serious business, and he wants the Galatians to look into their own hearts and ask, are you really trusting completely in the work of Christ to save you, or are you prone to look at yourself and think you are all right because you're comparatively not too bad? And Paul says that the answer to that question makes the difference in whether you are truly in Christ or just someone who calls himself a Christian but who is following a totally false religion that is an utter waste of time. Let's pray. Father, may we examine ourselves in the same way Paul was asking the Galatians to put their own hearts and convictions to the test. May we do that by the power of the Spirit in an honest and meaningful way. Confirm our faith, strengthen our convictions, as well as our character. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to Pastor and Teacher Phil Johnson. For more information about the ministry of the Grace Life Pulpit, visit at www.thegracelifepulpit.com. Copyright by Phil Johnson, all rights reserved.